Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the nature of the universe, and what has it taken for scientists to learn what we know about it? A month after announcing promising data from the Large Hadron Collider in its search for the elusive Higgs boson particle, scientists say they will likely be able to say for certain whether it exists by this summer. Whenever that day comes, it will represent a crowning achievement following decades of effort to understand why there is mass in the universe. My guest today is here to explain some of those developments and share the stories of the brilliant physicists who have collaborated and competed to bring them about. Frank Close is professor of physics at the University of Oxford and winner of the Kelvin Medal for contributions to the public understanding of physics. His new book is called The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Frank, welcome to Think.
Hello, hi.
We will probably be talking a lot about the science this hour, but in telling the stories of the scientists, you remind us that these brilliant people that we imagine as being almost superhuman are in fact very human. They have emotions and ambitions and professional rivalries and jealousies. That's no surprise to you.
No. In fact, well, I'm one of them, and I'm no different than anybody else, and scientists are not different than anybody else. I know that science itself is a very pure ideal, but it is done by people, and the cross-section of scientists is no different than any other cross-section of society. So there are heroes and villains and all things in between.
There are also people who are brilliant scientists, but perhaps some are very creative, some are very good at the math, and sometimes people don't have the combination of the two.
No, I think there are ideas people who don't calculate very well. I think I probably fall into that category. And there are those that can calculate superbly but don't always have good ideas. And things really work together very well when two people get together and can trust each other in that way.
Do the scientists on different sides of the skills set communicate well?
Yes and no. I mean, there are two broad areas in science here. There are what you might call the mathematicians, the theorists who come up with the ideas, and you can write beautiful ideas on pieces of paper just like you can write a beautiful symphony. Everybody agrees a symphony is beautiful if they hear it, but whether or not your ideas are beautiful and used by nature is the critical thing for science. You can write the most beautiful ideas imaginable, but if nature doesn't do it that way, it's a waste of your time. And it's experiment that determines what things are right and what things are wrong. So there are theorists and there are experimentalists.
So let's talk about your title, The Infinity Puzzle. First of all, why is infinity so problematic in contemporary physics?
Well, the problem really was at its height about half a century ago. The story is really of the great insights that happened in the 1960s that led through to this huge endeavor, the Large Hadron Collider now. But so why did I call it the Infinity Puzzle? Well, in the 1930s, actually, the first attempts to describe something as fundamental as just the electrons inside the atom and how they interact with light. There were these wonderful theories that have been around. There was the theory of electromagnetism from the 19th century. There was Einstein's theory of relativity, and there was the quantum theory. And each of these on their own was wonderful. But when you combine the three together to make what we called quantum electrodynamics, the quantum theory of the electromagnetic force, the simplest calculations look wonderful, but the moment you tried to refine them, which was necessary to get the final answer, suddenly infinity popped out of the calculation. Now, infinity is transcendent. It's beyond measure. It's meaningless in a sense. And if you get infinity coming out of your calculation, basically what it's saying is you haven't got a theory. There is something fundamentally wrong. I mean, the concept of something having infinite probability is meaningless. So what was being made clear was that something was fundamentally wrong. What to do about it? Well, that was solved in 1947 by Richard Feynman and others, who shared the Nobel Prize for solving the infinity puzzle in the particular case of the electromagnetic force. The problem was there's another force at work in nature that was very important and is very important, the one that cooks the elements in the stars, like the sun, turns hydrogen in the heart of the sun into helium, makes the elements that make you and me, and that's called the weak force of radioactivity. And the infinity puzzle trick that Feynman and people had discovered didn't work there. And it wasn't until 1971 that a young graduate student in his very first paper in his thesis, a man called Howard de Toft, a contemporary of mine working in Holland, solved the infinity puzzle for this force as well. And it's from that moment that everything suddenly fell into place, leading today to the search for the final piece in that whole story, which is the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider.
So what Feynman and then later Toft did was a procedure called renormalization. What is that trick, and why does it sort of fix some of the problems that are created?
Well, that's a very profound question. I do remember, I'm trying to get myself off a hook here, that Feynman, when he won the Nobel Prize, was asked by a reporter to describe his Nobel Prize work in, 30 seconds. And he said, if I could describe it in 30 seconds, it wouldn't have been worth a Nobel Prize. But I'll do my best. What he discovered was that the way that infinity popped out the calculations, it kept popping out in the same way here, there, and everywhere. And they discovered that if you were trying to calculate the mass of the electron, you found infinity. If you tried to calculate the amount of electric charge of the electron, you found infinity. But we've measured both of those two. So if you say, look, I'll just take the numbers that experimentalists have given me for the charge and the mass, and then calculate with those numbers to start with, suddenly everything fell into place. The numbers that they were calculating for other things, like how much magnetism does the electron have, for example, they calculated that, and it agrees the experiment to an accuracy of one part in a trillion, which is like measuring the width of the Atlantic Ocean to the width of a human hair. It's that level of precision. Hmm. So if you said, I'll accept two numbers and then I can work out lots of other things, you had sort of hidden the infinities out of sight, and that was what was given the grand name renormalization, or Feynman, who was much more direct, said, we swept the infinities under the rug.
So doing this, particularly in the early 70s for field theories, allowed quantum field theory to come roaring back to life. Can you give us a layperson's understanding, and again, I think I'm asking the impossible, but of what quantum field theory really encompasses?
Well, the basic thing about quantum theory is that you can't simultaneously know both where a thing is and how fast it's moving or how much energy it's got. And the harder you try to look and pin it down, the more it sort of beats you and jumps away from you. So if you try to look at what's going on in nature on very, very short spaces of time, you find energy popping in and out of existence all the time. Now, Einstein said that energy and mass are related, E equals MC squared. So this energy turns into particles of matter and particles of antimatter, which are bubbling in and out of existence all the while. So the basic tenet of quantum field theory is that the vacuum, the void, when you take everything out, you're not left with nothing. In fact, it's full of little weird particles, like will-o'-the-wisps bubbling in and out of existence. It sounds crazy, it sounds science fiction, but that is the way it is. And the quantum field theory is the mathematical way of taking that weirdness into account in order to calculate other things.
So this has been an exciting few weeks for anybody following developments in the search for the Higgs boson. First of all, remind us why this particle, if it turns out to exist at all, is so important and important enough to justify the billions of dollars we have spent in search of it.
Right. Well, that's going to take us a good hour, that will. but the first part of it anyway, the universe that we're in today is very different than it was in the first instant after the Big Bang. It was very, very hot then. And strangely enough, it turns out that our theories are much more successful to describe that first moment of the universe when things were hot, and the theories have nice features in them which would work well if things were moving around at the speed of light, which, of course, it's not like that. And we know that particles actually have mass. They move around more slowly. And the problem was that how did you get mass into the theory without completely ruining it? The infinity puzzle was solved as long as you closed your eyes to mass. And Peter Higgs and other people, or half a dozen people independently around 1964, found a mathematical trick which showed how to create mass spontaneously out of nowhere, if you liked, in the equations. And it was that trick which the mathematicians, the theorists, made use of, which Howard de Toft made use of in solving the infinity puzzle, that's excited us for 50 years. And out of those six people, Peter Higgs noticed one further feature, that a consequence of this idea was that there should exist a massive particle, which we call the Higgs boson after him, would be highly unstable, and if you could create this particle in an experiment and see what it decayed into, looking at the entrails after it died away, if you like, you could, from that, prove whether or not this trick was just a mathematician's idea or whether that's the way that nature really works. So it is looking for that critical final piece of evidence that this is indeed nature's symphony and not just some theorist's idea that is exciting people, because the Higgs boson is predicted to be very massive beyond the reach of experiments until this last few years. And the Large Hadron Collider at CERN was built in part to create in the laboratory the sort of conditions that would be able to show up the Higgs boson if it is really there.
Talk a little bit about how you create a device, a system that might bring into existence this particle that we can't entirely describe. We don't absolutely know it exists. So how do you make the factory that might create one?
Well, I suppose there's two things. First of all, how you make it, and then how do you know it when you've got it?
Yeah.
So how you make it. You've got to make a particle with a lot of mass. Mass is energy. You've got to be able to focus a lot of energy into a very small space, smaller than the size of an atomic nucleus even. And you do that by, first of all, ripping atoms apart so that the center of the hydrogen atom, the proton, you can speed a proton up by giving it pushes by electric forces, whirling it around a huge circle by using magnets. The circle is about 27 kilometers round, by the way. So you can have protons whirling around in one direction and have clever magnets which will send other beams of protons whirling around in the other direction, and then you smash these two beams into each other head-on. Each beam is moving pretty well at the speed of light, almost. So the two beams smash into each other head-on. And when two protons smash like that, the amount of energy released in that collision is vast. And if you are lucky, well, that energy then can turn into... So what you're doing in that experiment is replicating in the laboratory, for a brief moment, the sort of hot conditions that the universe itself was like within about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And that was the epoch when, if the theories are right, this Higgs boson should have been around. So the idea is, by making these mini replicas of the Big Bang and seeing what comes out of a little flash of energy that you have isolated in the experiment, if you are lucky, you might find a Higgs boson. So that's how you make it. How do you know you've got it? That's the hard bit, because out of this mini Big Bang doesn't just appear a Higgs boson. Oh, that it was so easy. Thousands of particles and antimatter particles come spewing out and are captured in the detectors. You're doing this over and over and over and over again. Each time, thousands of particles appear. And if you are lucky, once in a while, there will be a Higgs boson among the thousand particles in one in a thousand of these little experiments. So you're looking for a needle in a thousand haystacks. And that is why it takes so long to be able to filter this thing out, even if it is there, and then to be sure that you found the real deal when you find something that looks unusual.
Frank Close is with us. He's professor of physics at the University of Oxford and author of the new book, The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Now's your chance to ask your questions. The telephone lines are open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frank Close. He's professor of physics at the University of Oxford and author of the new book, The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also submit questions via email to think@kera.org. So Frank, you set us up with a nice little cliffhanger at the end of the last break. We are looking now for this Higgs boson, the needle in the proverbial haystack, and there are 1,000 haystacks. Now, in my mind, I imagine that you run one of these experiments, and then the world's greatest minds don, chemical suits and goggles and run in there with magnifying glasses. I know that's not the case. How do they examine the material that is left over after one of these?
Well, we don't need chemical suits, thankfully. what you're doing, you smash these particles together over and over because you don't know exactly what is going to happen. The strange thing about quantum theory, one of the many strange things about quantum theory, is that you only know the chance of something happening. So, for example, if I toss a coin now, I don't know if it'll land heads up or heads down. And however, if I toss it 100 times, I know it'll be roughly 50-50. Mm-hmm. So it's that sort of thing. That's what we're doing in physics. According to the theory, if you do this, if you smash these particles thousands of times, you should produce this sort of thing 10 times, that sort of thing 20 times, and so forth. But you don't know from time to time which way it will fall. So you do it over and over again. You look at the trails that have come out through these special cameras. These are huge detectors, the size of a cruiser, a battleship even. And this information is sent to computer screens. The World Wide Web is able to send it around universities around the world. There are people in the US working on this experiment who probably right now are sitting actually at a terminal someplace in the university, maybe in your local area, analyzing in real time the data that is coming out of the ongoing experiment. So it's quite remarkable how you do that. And you accumulate more and more evidence. You do more and more throws of the dice, if you like. I mean, the analogy that I drew is, suppose you've got some dice and you want to know if they're loaded. You keep throwing them. And after two or three throws, you might start thinking, oh, they're coming down sixes a little bit more than I expected. But you can't be sure that they're loaded dice at that point. It might just be a fluctuation of chance. But you do it 100 times, 1,000 times, and you start saying, aha, these are definitely loaded dice. There's something going on. So it's a bit like that, you know, that we are running the experiment, keep going on for longer and longer, doing more throws of the dice, if you like, until gradually what might be something interesting showing up becomes clearer and clearer that it's not just chance, it is something for real. So that's why it takes a long time to build up the evidence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the phones to Michael in Allen. Hi, Michael.
Hi. If I'm pronouncing it correctly, is it the Higgs boson particle that you were talking about?
Yes,
that's right.
Okay. I am not a science person, obviously, but I read a lot. And the question I had for you is, if I remember correctly, the Higgs boson particle is there, I believe, is connected to something called the theoretical Higgs boson bridge, basically wormholes, those sorts of things. And I hate to get you off on a tangent, but I'm just wondering if these particles are actually discovered, will that do anything towards helping people figure out if the theories of time travel are actually possible or not? And that might just be way too left field for the discussion you're having. And one little comment, your analogy about flipping the coin and it a 50% chance of it landing heads or tails. I'm being niggling here, but isn't there also an infinitesimal chance that when you flip a coin, it can also land on its edge? So that kind of means you have three possibilities as opposed to two.
Right. Well, that's a good point. Yes, there's an infinitesimal chance that it lands on its edge, which I suppose is the flip side to make a sort of joke of infinity. So in that sense, yes, but no. But fair enough. But with regards to the wormholes and things, no, the Higgs boson doesn't have anything at all to do with wormholes. That's something else. Whether time travel is or is not possible, well, first of all, I don't know. The second thing is that's outside my field. The third thing is nobody's come back to tell me whether it is or isn't. But even if it is, even if there are wormholes, the idea that a person could, even in principle, pass through one and come out the other side without themselves being ripped apart, I don't think in practice those things are going to be very much useful.
So talk about this for a minute, Frank. You described scientists here in Texas and there in England and everywhere else in the world, in Switzerland, looking for the results from these experiments and examining the data. That sounds very cooperative and collaborative, but you also describe a world here where it's pretty cutthroat and people are sort of deciding whether to keep information close to the vest or whether to publish it and get the credit for it. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, yes, it is. That on the one hand, it's a collective enterprise, not least because the quest of what you're doing here is so huge. 100 years ago, well, let me sort of jump sideways a minute. You know, people often say, why is it that you're having to do such big things now? Didn't Rutherford discover the atom just on a benchtop? And the answer is yes, Rutherford did. But the difference is this, that the atoms that Rutherford was exploring had been around for billions of years. If you like, nature did a lot of hard work early on, mm-hmm. creating matter from which atoms eventually formed. And so 100 years ago, we were taking the atoms that are there waiting for us, thank you very much, and were able to work out what they're made of with, relatively speaking, relatively simple experiments. And one or two people would be sufficient to do that, to tease the answers out. What we're now doing, as a result of the infinity puzzle, if you like, being cracked 40 years ago, our focus has changed not so much upon what matter is made of, but where did it come from in the first place? That first moment immediately after the Big Bang from which matter froze out and turned eventually into us. And so what we're doing is experiments that have to, if you like, travel back in time. So although time travel in the sense of the previous speaker isn't into this, in a metaphorical sense, the machine at CERN is able to recreate what the universe was like way back in the first moments when matter was being created. So we're studying how it was made and where it comes from. So that's the thing today. And you don't go along to your local science shop and say, can I have a Big Bang apparatus, please? You have to design it and build it. And it's been 20 years. And one of the things that I bring out in the book is that the time span involved in doing experiments of this magnitude are now very big. It's not just a matter of needing lots and lots of people who are experts right across the board, not just physics, but engineers, superconducting technology, pushing the frontiers of computer science. I must admit, 20 years ago, when the idea of doing this first really began to be taken seriously, I and many people felt this would never actually happen, that along the way, a lot of great discoveries in various areas of science and technology would be made, various advances would happen, but that we were probably biting off more than we could chew. The fact that 20 years later we have now a machine doing this, I find in itself a remarkable feat. The fact that we may find the Higgs boson or something totally unexpected, in that sense, is icing on the cake.
What happens if, for whatever reason, we confirm that this thing doesn't exist?
Well, that's one thing that science actually can't do. You can never prove a negative.
Yeah.
But a fair point that, you know, we have ideas of what one is looking for, and if it should turn out that after a long period of time, however hard you look, things aren't showing up, then you will say, well, pretty confident that it ain't there, then what? Well, I don't think it'll turn out like that, though, of course, it could do. And this, in part, is the nature of the thing. Although I or somebody else may have an idea what I think we're looking for, only nature knows. Hmm. That's why we do experiments, that we are trying to find out what nature is really like, and sometimes it is like what we think. Other times it isn't, and nature knows, and hopefully soon we will know one way or the other.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Daniel on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Daniel.
Howdy.
Hi.
All right. So I'm a big idea kind of guy. I'm not good with numbers, so bear with me. And I'll speak in broad, sweeping generalizations for your host here. I have a question more or less along the methods that are chosen to try to recreate this Big Bang scenario. Don't you find a silly irony that our best scientists just basically still explode things? I mean, we're still making fireworks. What I want to know is, why don't scientists try to compress all of the known elements of what they think was in what this ball of matter or whatever was the bang, that was the Big Bang? Why are we crushing atoms and protons into one another if that's not all of the ingredients that was there to cause the bang? Am I making sense?
No, I understand what you're concerned with. First of all, don't worry about the idea that, you know, when I say vast amounts of energy involved, in actual fact, the amount of energy when these particles collide each other is, in fact, incredibly small. It's less than the energy in a puff of air. The remarkable thing is that it's concentrated in such a small volume. So, if you like, the concentration of energy is the big deal. So one's not, in that sense, exploding things, in fact, far from it. What we're doing, I mean, the fact that we're using particles to liberate this energy is because that's the only way we know how to do it. The interesting thing is to be able to create, by some means, a little mini version of the immediate aftermath of the Big Bang to see what it evolves into. We are not creating the real Big Bang. We are looking at the universe as it was just after it. Why there was a Big Bang, I haven't got a clue. Whether there was anything before the Big Bang, not even sure if that question is meaningful, but that at the moment is certainly beyond science. So one of the things I feel people have probably, from a lot of media reports, got a wrong impression is when you hear it referred to as the God particle. There is not, to my knowledge, a single practicing physicist who ever refers to this as the God particle for many reasons. Even people who are very deeply religious and believe fervently in there being a God do not refer to it by that name, because we are not creating a mini-universe. We are looking at how, after the universe was created by whatever means, did it evolve into the stuff that we now find around us? So that is the sort of strategy that we're trying to achieve, is to understand the origins of stuff. You were saying also, why don't you compress atoms? Well, people are doing that, but that's with a different aim, the aim of trying to liberate more of the energy that's trapped in stuff. I mean, biology, chemistry, and so forth is getting energy out of atoms, but the most efficient that we have, even nuclear fusion, which we have not yet achieved in practice, would only liberate about 1% of the energy that's locked up inside matter. So attempting to find ways of extracting energy from matter is what a lot of technological industrial society is about, and people certainly are trying to do that, but that's another area of science.
Why do you think that persistent and problematic term God particle caught on? I mean, does the blame lie with myself and my colleagues in the media? Is that why it stuck?
Never blame the media.
No, I mean, there's big money in that, actually.
put God in the title of a book, and it sells more copies, and it got picked up and run with. And I know that many of my colleagues feel you know, very upset every time they hear it, and I likewise. I think it is misleading for many reasons. It has, I think, created a bad impression. I mean, I think certainly Angels and Demons by Dan Brown, for example, certainly amplified the impression that somehow CERN is replaying creation and mm-hmm. creating a universe out of nothing, and nothing could be farther from the truth.
We have an email here from Steve who says, will we find the Higgs boson has components to its composition? When will we drill down to the final particle of existence?
That's a very good question, Steve. In fact, when we say the Higgs boson, it's probably worthwhile just saying what's happened. In 1964, these six people who came up with the idea, and Peter Higgs, who focused on its implication, the simplest way of playing this trick could be achieved by nature if there is a single particle which has been called the Higgs boson. It may be that nature does it the simplest way, or it may do this trick a more complicated way. For example, that the Higgs boson is actually composed of deeper things. And one of the possibilities that's been considered very seriously is that there are things called techniquarks, to give them a name, which are clumped together. And when they act in pairs, the overall thing looks like a boson. So it's certainly possible that may be what we find out. And that's part of the excitement. I have no doubt myself that nature is playing the game, but quite how it does it is the thing that I'm excited to learn.
What changes once we finally understand this?
Well, to answer that question in part, I need to know what we're going to find from it.
Yeah.
But I think that the simplest thing is this, that we have built this big description, which we call the Standard Model. It describes the fundamental particles, the basic nature, the basic letters of nature's alphabet, if you like, and the forces that act on them, which is like the grammar that cluster them together to make meaningful language. And for 40 years, these ideas have been refined, and as I said earlier, one can calculate consequences to remarkable precision. There is, however, one missing ingredient, which is in order to solve this infinity puzzle, there has to be this final ingredient in this part of the story, and that is what this search for this Higgs boson is all about. So if we find it, then the simplest thing is it will confirm that we are indeed dealing with reality and not with some theoretical whim. The exciting thing then would be to find out precisely what the nature of this thing is. Is it a single particle? Is it composed of other things? If so, what are they? Is it just one on its own, or is it just the beginning of a whole new family of things? The whole region in what the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is doing is replicating an epoch of the early universe when, according to theory, the Higgs boson was around, but also those theories say that many other interesting things should have been happening at that time.
So Frank, let me jump in here.
Higgs boson, then I think it would show that we're on the right track to finding what was going on in a very rich time in the early universe.
Frank Close is my guest. His new book is called The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Calvin Medal winner Frank Close is my guest. He's professor of physics at the University of Oxford and author of the new book, The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Join us on the phones at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Ricky, calling from Princeton. Hi, Ricky.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well. Hi. Thank you.
Yes, I have a question for you, sir. I was interested in, first of all, I find your work very interesting. I've read nothing but quantum mechanics since I was probably about 14 years old and relativity and stuff. It's just a hobby. I don't understand a lot of it, but it's very interesting. And I was wondering, in the hypothetical question, during the Big Bang, is it possible that instead of just everything going boom and then expanding out, could an electromagnetic field preceded the Big Bang and played a part in the distribution of matter over antimatter?
What do you think, Frank?
Well, I've no idea what happened before the Big Bang. I don't even know if it's meaningful to even pose it, because there's a common misconception that, like, there was a universe of emptiness waiting there and this bang happened in it. And it's not like that, that space and time were created in that instance. So what happened beforehand, I don't know. But the point you raised about matter and antimatter, that's actually a very good one, which is that the Big Bang, whatever caused it, was incredibly intense energy, and energy then can coagulate into matter and antimatter, perfect opposites of one another. And we all know from Star Trek, and this is indeed science fact, that when matter and antimatter meet, they annihilate each other, if you like, returning into the energy that had spawned them in the first place. So that then raises the question, well, if the universe was like energy turns into matter and antimatter, why is it that a zillionth of a second later, the new formed matter and antimatter didn't mutually self-destruct? Why is there anything left? And that is a question to which we do not yet have a clear answer. And it's one of the big questions that we have on the list. Why is it that 13.5 billion years after the Big Bang, what we find in the universe, the remnants of the Big Bang's energy is still around? It's very cold today. It's the 3 degrees microwave background radiation. There's a lot of matter, the stuff that makes you, me, and the stars and galaxies, so far as we can tell, but there is no evidence whatsoever for antimatter in bulk. We can make individual particles of it, and even a few atoms of antihydrogen, but antimatter at bulk seems to be absent, as far as we can tell. What caused this imbalance to happen, I don't know, but the fact that it did happen is critical for our existence today, and one of the questions which we hope the LHC might give us some insight into is to why does matter win out in the big first moments.
Is it any easier, Frank, for you as a physicist and for your colleagues to get your heads around these, you know, infinities and the reality of absolutely nothing existing before the Big Bang than it is for the rest of us sitting out here trying to get a sense of all this?
Well, of course, I don't know. When you say the rest of us, I think at this point, being a scientist doesn't make it any different, I think. That these are really profound things. I do recall, I mean, I wrote a book called Nothing, actually, before this present one. When I was a very young lad, I remember asking myself, you know, what would happen if, you know, all the stars weren't there and the sun and the moon wasn't there and the earth wasn't there and I wasn't here and nobody's here, there'd be nothing. And then I started worrying about this. If you actually just think this through a second, imagine removing everything and removing everybody and you yourself. There'd be nothing, but there'd be nobody to know that there was nothing. And I then began to feel that I was either going to, in some sort of Zen sense, get the path to true enlightenment, or I would go totally crazy. So I moved on to do other things. But actually, that question was posed by the ancient Greeks, and Aristotle, you know, 3,000 years ago, insisted there is no such thing as nothing. And trying to understand the nature of nothing has been very profound. And in the modern parlance where you've got quantum mechanics, which says things can fluctuate in and out of nowhere, the possibility that the universe itself, I mean, in the sense to answer this question, that the universe itself could be a quantum fluctuation out of nothing is indeed taken seriously. But that, of course, to me begs the question, but who, what, and where has encoded the rule that says you can fluctuate a universe out of nothing? You go round and round in circles.
Well, you know, it's all really beautiful and profound to consider. I am thinking about your poor mother. Was she like, please go outside and play football for a while?
Well, maybe. I mean, I now, with kids of my own, you sort of see it, that very young children, I mean, listeners who have got very young children, please go along with them when they ask questions. I think that there is no difference between those of us in adulthood who carry on being scientists and what all of us were doing when we were, you know, in our first years of life. Young babies are trying to make sense of the universe, the world around them. They're doing experiments. You know, they crawl around, they feel things, they play. They're playing, but in fact, they are learning. They're doing experiments by seeing how things work together. And then, of course, they start speaking, and that's a delightful time. And then they start asking questions, which is a delightful time. And then they start asking questions that you don't know the answer to. And at a certain point when you're doing something else, say, oh, go away and don't waste my time. And some kids go away, but they continue asking questions and they become scientists. And that's what we are all born as, in my opinion.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Asa in Dallas. Hi, Asa.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I had a question for the gentleman on the show today.
Okay.
I would like to ask him how they were accelerating the particles. I know that, you know, with electricity, it's repelling and pulling in. I was just curious to know if it was a big circle, like he was saying, if it went around in a circle, or if it eventually spiraled down to where it would increase the speed.
Okay. Well, the whole series, I mean, how they do it is a long story. It's a bit, to draw an analogy, you rip some atoms apart, you've got protons, which are positively charged particles. And if you apply an electric field, like, you know, a battery will accelerate an electrically charged particle. If you've got a very powerful electric field, you can accelerate the particle a lot. And you start off by having a relatively small circle, and the particles are going around that, if you like being in first gear in your automobile. And then you put them into a bigger circle, which is like second gear, and then finally you send them into the huge ring, which is about 27 kilometers around. It's 100 meters below the ground, 27 kilometers around, and you have got magnets which are steering the beams around that huge circle. And they're spinning round and round. The beams are, most of the time, they just pass straight through each other. It's like two clouds of gnats, if you like, just flying through each other, and only occasionally do two gnats hit each other head on. Mm. So you've got a zillion particles coming around. Maybe if you're lucky, one bumps into one coming the other way. And if not, doesn't matter. You go all the way around the ring again and have another try, 1,000 times a second. So that's basically how it works.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Jim calling from Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Thank you, dear. Actually, I want to change my question. I was curious as if the antimatter might be responsible or thought to be responsible for the acceleration of the expanding universe, and also if you could give us a little definition of what physicists mean when they say, when they use the term field. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. Right. Well, could antimatter be responsible for the acceleration of the universe? Interesting question. I don't think so, but to go back, there, matter and antimatter from the outside look just the same. The hydrogen atom has got positive electrical charge in the middle, carried by a proton, and negative on the outside, carried by an electron. The anti-hydrogen atom has the electric charges swapped around. The electron, instead of being negative, is positive. We call it positron. And the proton in the middle, instead of being positive, is negative. We call it antiproton. And the basic rules of electricity are that opposite charges attract, and so anti-hydrogen atoms will attract and hold themselves together exactly following the same rules that hydrogen will. And so it's the attraction of opposite charges that holds atoms together. Now, it's a miracle that the amount of negative charge and positive charge exactly counterbalance each other, so that matter overall has got no charge left over, if you like. But one of the ideas that was around, this is now probably 30, 40 years ago, the Big Bang is what we all regard as what's going on now, but Fred Hoyle in particular thought it might be possible that there could be a little imbalance between negative charge and positive charge, so that the universe was indeed being thrust apart by electrical repulsion. We now know that that is not the case, but it was an interesting idea that was around, and experiment showed that it wasn't the case. That's, to go back to what I was saying at the very start, you can have wonderful ideas, but experiment shows you whether they're right or not. Then you said, what do we mean by a field? Probably it might be easiest just to give an analogy. Magnetic fields are things that people probably feel comfortable with. You have a magnet, and two magnets feel a force. If you put a lot of little pieces of iron dust on a sheet and you put a magnet near them, you'll see them move around, forming pretty patterns, which sort of give us the feeling there is this influence filling space, like the gravitational field. The Earth is going around in the gravitational influence of the Sun. Precisely what that is, I don't know, but I do know how it works. So it's a concept that we invent to explain space being filled with this mysterious stuff. So that's just the word field that we give to it. And the electromagnetic field is one example. The Higgs field is the current example that we're interested in seeing if that is also really there. I hope that helps.
We've got a question here from Doug, who is expressing a concern that I think a lot of people outside the field of physics have had. Doug asks, what's the probability of the LHC producing antimatter or a mini black hole particle?
A mini black hole. Well, when you say concern, one of the theories is that we hope that it might be able to produce mini black holes, but there's no concern there. I think probably what concern means is, could you produce something which would destroy the planet or have some terrible implication? Because I know that this question was being raised a few years ago. And the answer to that, with confidence, I can say no. And how do I know that? Is this, that this is not the first time that this experiment has been done. In fact, the universe did it, if you like, just after the Big Bang. But out there in space, there are cosmic rays, which are bits of atoms that have been produced by stars that exploded, whipped up by the magnetic fields in space. Some of them smash into the upper atmosphere and create things like the Northern Lights, for example. So these cosmic rays consist of particles at much higher energies than anything at all we can even achieve at the Large Hadron Collider. So this experiment, if you like, is being done all the time out there. It's just the first time that we have been able to do it down here under controlled conditions. So, you know, if there was something awful that was going to happen, it would have happened and we wouldn't even be here at this point having the conversation. So I don't, there are many things to worry about in life, and that isn't one of them.
Can you talk for a minute about, if there's one group of people that have, I think, a more challenging job than the physicists working at the Large Hadron Collider looking for the Higgs boson particle, it might be the Nobel Committee every year figuring out who deserves the top honor in physics. How does that process work, and how do they decide who actually deserves the honors?
Well, the way the process works is that they first of all solicit nominations from former Nobel Prize winners and from other influential scientists of what they regard as the major advances that have not yet been given awards. And then from that, they obviously identify which ones are being nominated a lot. And then they choose a short list, which referees examine and write detailed reports on, which takes a huge amount of work for people. And from that moment on, then the Academy in Stockholm make a decision out of this short list and the referees' report, which is the one they will award the prize to. Now, that last stage is, all of it is done in secret, but I mean, having been involved in some of the nomination process, at least I know how the early stages work, but that final stage is done secretly, in total confidence, in Stockholm, and the award is announced in October and the award given in December, and the papers on that are kept secret for, I think it's maybe 50 years, and even then, only if all the people concerned are no longer alive. So the actual details are kept secret, though occasionally one can find things that come out, as I did while researching the Infinity Puzzle, and it gave some insights into how Nobel Prizes have been awarded to some individuals and also why some people missed out. But that's another story, as they say.
Frank Close is professor of physics at the University of Oxford and the winner of the Kelvin Medal for contributions to the public understanding of physics. His new book is called The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Frank, it's been a great conversation. Thank you for your patience with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.